when you're ready.
Except then I didn't.
Okay. The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Colleagues, today we have two work sessions scheduled. I don't expect to vote on either of these bills because there are some things that need to be pulled together. But we do have some amendments to discuss, and I notice we have a couple of members and some other distinguished people here to talk about one of them, so we'll open that one first, and we'll open the work session on House Bill 4005. Chris, do you want to talk to us about where we are on that and what the amendments, proposed amendments, do?
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4005, there are two amendments in OLIS, a dash 4 and a dash 5. Each of them replaces the introduced bill. So that introduced language is irrelevant under those scenarios. The dash 4 increases the cap on the number of electronic commerce zones from 10 to 13 and extends the manufacturing Betsy 2 years, so the new sunset date would be January 1, 2016. The dash 5 does those same two policies plus increases the cap, the tax credit cap on the research and development tax credit from $1 million to $2 million. That's the per taxpayer cap. So within OLIS, you have most of the paperwork. You have some SMSs, and you have revenue impacts for each of those.
I see.
So if you look at the revenue impact for the dash 5, because that includes the impact from the dash 4, we see that the revenue impact for the 13-15 biennium is minus $1.3 million and then minus $9.9 million to minus about $10.5 million. And again, the dash 4 amendment has the same revenue impact except the R&D credit. So a couple pieces about that. The e-commerce zone, that's just proportioned up from our experience with the revenue loss for that tax credit. The manufacturing tax credit, it extends the sunset date for preliminary research 2 years. The assumption there is that $10 million in credits would be awarded in each of tax year 2015 and 2016. That accounts for the time lag between the pre-cert and the final cert. And the $10 million, I spoke with Business Oregon, that is less than the historical average of the credits issued. As the committee, I think, is well aware, this is a credit that either happens or doesn't happen. And so in any 1 year, it can be zero, or it can be $15 million or more, or up to the $20 million. But the revenue pack reflects an expected value, or kind of an average over time.
Okay, thank you. I think the two members are here on the e-commerce zone. Why don't you come up? And then do we have other people here? The other two of you are talk about the e-commerce zone? No. Yeah, City of Eugene then, yeah. That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Colleagues, just while they're sitting down, let me just say that what we're trying to do is piece a bill together that will sort of encompass the entire ask for the legislature for this session. And there are three or four pieces, e-commerce zone, manufacturing credit, R&D credit, and the restatement of the apportionment issue for broadcasters are among those pieces that we're currently talking about. These three are here to talk about the e-commerce zone. So let's go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chairman Barnhart and members. For the record, Lee Byer, State Senator from Central Linn and Lane Counties. And here to talk about the dash 4 specifically, the electronic expanding, but as your staff said, what it does is merely expands under existing law the number of allowable e-commerce zones from 10 to 13. And why the expansion? Because the other 10 are already used. I guess if I would make the argument, as I had before, that the enterprise zone piece of it in general, we tried last time saying it really ought to be up to the cities whether they want to give away their property taxes or not, and I've never understood, having worked with it for over 20 years now, why the legislature decided that it ought to do the mother may I on it. But that's not here nor there. We're talking about these. Specifically, These zones have been and are awarded on a competitive basis. My communities that I represent have not been in the mix for these before, but they are now. There's an interest in Representative Lively will probably get to this. I've been involved in economic development, or was retired, for probably 30 years in the Lane County area, and have worked closely with these kinds of companies coming together, and know what it takes to incent them to make a decision. Sometimes the particular issue that we're dealing with in my community is we have a former computer fab that has been empty for almost a decade. People have tried very hard to try and get clients in there, but it's been a hard fit. We currently have clients that are interested in that building, and we're trying to look to what does it take to put them over the top to get it going. And frankly, the bottom line is something that this committee spends a lot of time talking about, is when that plant closed, the local governments and the schools in the area lost hundreds of millions of dollars of taxes. And so we would like to get that back onto the tax rolls and do that. What the e-commerce zones essentially do is they match up the property tax exemption with an income tax waiver for a limited number of years. It's not very long. It's 3 to 5 years, depending on how the enterprise zone is structured. And frankly, if you look at the impact of the ones that have been created, while they may be an inducement to a business, oftentimes it doesn't materialize into very much. For the simple reason is when you're starting up a new company, chances are you're not going to show any profit for a few years. But it's still there. It helps. It's a little bit that would make a difference. And I recognize that if you add the three, that the department, through their normal and routine processes, would have a competitive opportunity there. And so that's why, you know, we would still, the community of Eugene would still have to go through that process to ask for one. But I think it's an opportunity. It's one of those things, we talk a lot about job creation around here, and this is one of the little things that we may be able to do that would incent it. Some people will argue, I will tell you, that we shouldn't have to do this, and frankly, I would agree with them. I wish the Congress could pass a law that said none of the states could do inducements, but that's not reality. We're in that business reluctantly, so we have to learn how to play with it. The other one is talk about the lost revenue if we do this, but I will tell you from experience with almost a decade of no revenue that getting 100% of nothing is still nothing. What we're trying to do is put businesses and money back into the tax system with a little patience on our part as government entities. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Lively.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Lively. I'm state representative from Springfield. I'm in Senator Byers' district. There's irony to me even being here today. Those members of my caucus know that I speak pretty strongly against tax incentives and tax expenditures, even though I've spent my life almost working in economic development and taking advantage of and using those. But here I am, for several. I've also come to understand how the legislature works and how you have to go through this process. Nonetheless, first, just let me say that I appreciate the work that's been done to understand the impacts of this particular incentive versus others. And while it does have an impact, it has a pretty minimal impact. And as Senator Byers said, it really only has an impact if the company, if there's income in which to take the credit against. And so from my standpoint, that's important. Yeah. Secondly, it is, I'm with Senator Byers when it comes to, I wish we could get out of this business of doing this and allow businesses to operate and compete. But as long as the other states are doing it, we need to. In this particular case, given the years that I've worked in economic development, I'm still doing that. That's what I do for a living outside of the legislature. I just know that when you're working with clients and you sit in the room and try to understand what's going to take at the end of the day to try to make the deal work, there becomes a list of things. And in this case, with this abandoned semiconductor plant in Eugene, they've tried for years with multiple clients to try to convert. It's a huge facility that's sitting out there that's not being used. And frankly, if we don't find a use pretty quick, they're going to tear it down. For good reason, because it's sitting there and it's going to, and so the client, people that own it want to. We have an opportunity, a client that's been around for quite a while, worked up and down trying to find a way to put this together. The city and the county, I think it was last year, expressed an interest through resolutions of applying for an e-commerce zone. It didn't go forward because the project didn't move forward, and there was no e-commerce zones at that point that they apply for. We're back here today because I can tell you the client's still there. There's some deadlines being met. I've met with them, and that's still on the table, that their clients, the people that would locate in the facility and operate there and create the jobs, feel this is an important part of being able to close the deal. I can't sit here and guarantee you if indeed the state has three more and the city were to apply and they'd get it, that the deal's done. That's, you know, we just, I just can't do that. I wish I could. I tried to get the client to say absolutely that they would, but I worked with them long enough to understand that's not the case. But it is very important. We understand, we and Eugene Springfield understand, that if we can approve this, becomes effective, it's still up to Business Oregon to make that decision. The communities would have to apply for and make the case. I can tell you, as the economic development person working on this, I'd make a very strong case. We'd bring the client to the table and sit there and be able to close this deal. So I encourage your support of increasing the number of e-commerce zones available in the state to three. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Howe. I represent the city of Eugene, and first I want to thank Senator Byron, Representatives Lively and Barnhart for your support on this effort. Increasing the number of e-commerce zones is critical for redevelopment of properties and industrial zones in Eugene. As you just heard from Representative Lively, there is an offer getting closer to closing. The Hynix plant, which Senator Beyer was mentioning, was Eugene's biggest taxpayer, bigger than the next nine combined. So there's been a pretty gaping hole in our property tax revenues. The e-commerce zone will be that one additional incentive that may attract and close the deal to plug that hole for revenues that, of course, are critical to education and other services in Eugene. And this particular client could bring up to 300 to 400 jobs to our city, and $150 million investment. It's a piece that would be really helpful to our local community. So we ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Let me simply note that on Wednesday we heard from the state economist who talked about the relative growth around the state and indicated that Central Lane County is one of the laggards. So this would be of help.
We've noticed that, Mr. Chair.
Yes, yes, so have I. All right, thank you very much.
We appreciate
your testimony on this amendment. And I see Business Oregon in the audience, ready to talk. Tim, you're here on something else.
I'm here. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tim McCabe, director of the Business Development Department. I'm here in support of extending the sunset date on the manufacturing Betsy. I want to go on record one more time, and many of you have heard me say this many, many times over. I do not, as reported in the press, consider this program a failure. I consider it a great success. And the reason being, this program was brought in 2008 when the first Betsy's were claimed. It was actually brought in 2006. But in 2008, the first Betsy's were issued. If through 2012, all of the Betsy's that are eligible are claimed, the state will have extended $51 million in credits. Not what's reported, the hundreds of millions of dollars that have gone out. $51 million, if every one of them is claimed. During that same period of time, the state will have realized revenues of $35 million. These aren't estimates, these are facts, okay? So a net difference is $16 million. During that time, during the height of recession, over 1,200 people were employed as a result of these Betsy's. I think they would consider it a success. 815 of those 1,200 people are still employed today. So we're looking from 2008 to today, 815 people that have jobs as a result of this. I think that's a success. Currently in this industry, there's 1,053 people that are employed. As I said, 815 of those as a result of the Betsy program. So it's far from a failure. I think if you ask them, they'd consider a success. All I'm asking is that you allow this to extend it for another 2 years. And I'll tell you quite frankly, there's nothing on the horizon that qualifies for a Betsy today, the way it's structured. As Chris said, we had an opportunity. It was a large battery manufacturer. That's not going to happen. So, and we've said no to two solar companies over the last year and a half. So, and I don't see anything, but that isn't to say it couldn't happen, and that's why I'd like to keep it alive and allow us to come back to you in 2015 with some recommendations that broadens this, not the amounts, but I've got an astute individual in my department by the name of Art Fish who's suggesting an income tax-based program that's based on the gross annual payroll, where we enter into contracts and they agree to do things and the state gets a positive return within a five-year period. We need to look at this in detail, but to allow this one just to sunset and go away, I think, would be a mistake. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. McCabe? I have one, and I'd like your help with this revenue impact statement. It sounds as though what you're saying is that the cost in 15, 17, and 17, 19 is somewhat speculative. That in fact, if you don't get to place credits because there's no appropriate application, then the cost is zero. Have I got that right?
Representative Barnard, members of the committee, you could be right, but in fact, what we've got is the actual tables of what's available and what can be claimed. Now, okay. If they don't have the ability to claim those credits, yes, it could be zero, but if you take it out, I'm assuming that just a little bit over $22 million would have been claimed in 2012. It may be lower than that. But I'm taking the highest possible number to show the impact. And I think $16 million over that six-year period, it's a lot of money, but it's not as much money as being reported out there. But in answer to your question, yes, that could happen. But what's going to happen... In 2012, there's $22 million available. In 2013, it's $18 million, $18.8 million that's available. 16.6 in 14, then it drops down to 8.6, and then $491,000, and we're done. But realize, over that same period of time, the state's going to be realizing revenue with the jobs that have been created.
Representative Berger.
Thank you. Tim, I think what you're saying is that if we allow this to lapse, it takes a tool out of your toolbox as you go forward. It isn't that immediately you're going to land one of these fish, but you won't have a hook in the water if we take away this
Representative Berger,
tool.
That's exactly right. You know, and it may not come along, but if something does come along, and I have to say. And again, you've all heard me say this countless times. We said no to more companies than we've said yes to. We didn't bat 100%. I grant you that, but it's hard to do. We're very, very, we look at these, opportunities very, very closely. As I said, we said no to two solar companies. We've had other companies come that aren't in solar that, you know, they're not real, but if we don't have this and somebody real comes along, which they're out there and they're looking, large companies out of Japan are still looking and they're going to expand, we're out of the game entirely. So you're exactly right.
So follow up. So it's essentially Representative Lively's argument is you need the tool. You may not use it, but you need the tool in your toolbox as part of what you can offer to land a significant fish.
Representative Berger, members of the committee, that's exactly right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bentz and then Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director, for being here. And I've asked this question before, but I'll ask it again. We heard in the earlier panel concerns about competitive posture vis-a-vis competing states and the need to have these tools available to compete. And so where on the playing field is Oregon right now? In your opinion, let's assume that this tool and toolbox is continued. Where are we? And just compare us to the three surrounding states.
Well, Representative Vance, member of the committee, I consider us. We've got many tools in our quiver or arrows in our quiver, there are so many factors that go into that. I to compare us to Washington's got some great incentives based on they're looking to attract data centers, and by that they suspend a tax on all electronic equipment installed in the first year, which these electronic equipment amounts in the millions, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars. So that's a great incentive up in the state of Washington. We've got great electricity rates. We've got a great workforce here. We've got many things. But if we're looking at this specific industry, we're out of the game without this. I mean, we have nothing to offer. And our competition isn't the surrounding states for this. It's Texas. It's New York. It's Alabama and the Carolinas.
Yes, please.
I guess we should follow this up with what is it, in addition to this, that you would suggest we offer?
I think, Representative Bentz, members of the committee, I think what I'd ask you to is to give us some time to come back to you with some recommendations and take a look at this annual payroll tax incentive to where we enter into agreements and long-term agreements with these companies where they don't get this up front. They have to be here for a while to earn it. You know, and once that's established and we know they're going to be long-time residents of Oregon, then it's a win-win.
This is premature, obviously, because you're going to come back to us, but the payroll tax incentive is designed to reduce that which the folks that go to work for the company pay in tax? Is that what you're saying?
Or is it Representative Bentz, members of the committee, no, that's not what I'm saying. It doesn't reduce anything. It looks at how much revenue the state's going to make, and we incent them based on that, and then we'll look at percentages. And I'm not an expert on this. Art it has done a very good job. He actually brought this to me 4 years ago, and we've been looking at it. And he Art's got a lot more on the ball than I do when it comes to this one.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. So the question I have is really how do we know? I mean, it's the question of the but-for, right? But for this incentive, businesses would be here or not be here. And I know that comes up when we're taking a look at, well, what really has been the economic impact of having these businesses in Oregon? I mean, we know manufacturing is one of the leading, you know, business drivers in our state, and we're very strong in that, which is very good. But, you know, as part of these programs, it would be great to be able to say not just that we know what the cost would be, what we're giving up in some of these incentive programs, but it's what's also the impact, not just in terms of number of jobs, but in the actual income taxes that we're getting because of the jobs. And I think that's something that as we look at the effectiveness of these programs and if they're worth the costs of, you know, using other what, you know, taxpayer money that we would otherwise get, making sure that they are actually valuable tools, not just in getting businesses here, but helping support, you know, the business of the state.
Representative Vega Peterson, members of the committee, I couldn't agree with you more.
So, follow up.
Was that a question?
No. Wait. Let me make it a question. I guess I would say what could you recommend to help us get that information and to help us when we're making the decisions about whether these programs are actually worthwhile or not?
Representative Vega Peterson, members of the committee, I can supply you that information. We call it what's called an in-plan study. It shows the effect of the direct, the induced, and the indirect jobs created as a result of these incentives, and I'd be happy to provide you with that.
And follow up?
Yes.
Does that go into actual the income taxes that were generated? Okay, yeah.
Representative, yes, good. It does.
Yeah, I would love to see that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Davis? Oh, not on this topic. All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Yeah. Now, the third piece of this that we were talking about is the R&D credit. Several members have expressed an interest in this. I wonder if any of them would like to be heard on the topic. Representative Davis.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the time. So as this committee knows, the R&D tax credit has been in existence on the federal level since the early 1980s. From what I can tell, Oregon adopted an R&D credit in 2000 and, it was increased to $2 million in 2005 and then reduced to a maximum of $1 million by the 2011 legislature. What this bill would do would increase it back to a $2 million per taxpayer credit availability. This committee and the Joint Tax Credit Committee has spent considerable time examining the effectiveness of tax credits. I think others on this committee believe this is a very effective credit to induce and spur additional research and development. As best I can tell, about 40 other states have R&D tax credits, so we are competing in a sense, not only with other states, but also with many other countries who have subsidies and incentives for research and development. And for the industries that we're trying to support in Oregon, I think this is a great way to do it.
Thank you. Representative Berger, please.
Yes, members, knowing that this was coming our way, I just happened to pick up my latest copy of State Legislature Magazine, which probably come to all of you. Mm-hmm. I meant to grab it and didn't, but just found online they have an article on tax incentives and how to be careful about them. But in it, they assert that Maine's annual evaluations, and they tout this as Maine doing evaluations, and that's really the subject of the article, is states should evaluate, and Maine's annual evaluations of the state's entire portfolio of investments in research and development have consistently found a 10 to 14-fold return on investment for the state. Well, that speaks to the fact that this can be an effective tool. Now, I don't have a one-to-one comparison between ours and Maine's, but clearly this is an investment that can give very good returns and has that history. So I just bring that article to your attention.
Thank you. Representative Bailey, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think colleagues, most of you will remember the time that we spent on the Joint Tax Credit Committee examining this credit, the time when it was cut from $2 million to $1 million. At that time, I think we were operating on some relatively limited information, given that there hadn't been a huge history of use of it up to that point. What we've since found, and I've heard from several businesses, is that the way the business models are changing, this has actually now been a constraint with that cut, and I think it was perhaps a little bit of an experiment that now we're seeing a little bit better what the results of that were. Certainly, as Oregon pursues an innovation-based economy, and I think that we are putting a lot of stake in that, that this could be a very useful tool as we incent the kinds of businesses and economic growth here in Oregon that I think are a good play for this state.
A question for those who are interested in this, expansion or restoration, I guess you could call it. Is it useful, even if it doesn't apply until July of 15? I'm trying to anticipate arguments being made in other quarters.
Mr. Chair, I can't speak for everybody. I can speak for myself and say that I think that putting a marker down for future business investment is probably a worthwhile thing, and so I think that there's some positives there.
Mr.
Chair, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to pick up on that answer, I agree with Representative Bailey. On the other hand, as with this and with most other economic development strategies and policies, we employ, there's a fair bit of uncertainty, and if we don't act now, who knows what we might be missing out on.
Right, and just to make it clear, what I'm proposing is the possibility of acting now on something that wouldn't actually go into effect until the next biennium.
Understood, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And so may I refine slightly my
right.
comment, which
yes.
is to say that if it doesn't take effect now, we might also be missing out on things. We won't know that, of course, probably ever.
Right.
But the sooner it's in effect, the better.
Thank you, Representative Davis.
A third option, Chair, would be to have the effectiveness be for the 2014 fiscal year. I discussed this with staff. Many businesses are still within their 2013 fiscal year, so putting down a marker of 2014 would allow them, for example, if they they close their fiscal year June 30th, they'd know that July 1 of 2014, they could begin taking advantage of this credit.
Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that would be helpful for us as we consider this is to see geographically where the R&D credit is used. I raised this issue, I almost raised it with the director a few minutes ago, in talking about the East Commerce Zones and other things. Most are going to be used in a three-county area, perhaps Eugene, also maybe Salem. But it's unlikely, because of the way things work in this state, that they're going to be used elsewhere. This is not to say that I would oppose it just geographically, but I certainly want to be able to see what the rest of the state's chipping in when it comes to these kinds of investments. And then we can link back how those parts of the state are helping other parts of the state and consider if indeed they are. So I think it's super important that we look at the broad picture, which I know Vice Chair Bailey did in the Tax Credits Committee. And we've all been through these conversations many times, but I want a more geographical look so we can kind of compare how it's really working for all areas of the state at maybe three or four different levels.
Thank you. We'll see what Chris can do burning the midnight oil over the weekend.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Have fun.
Thank you. All right. I will simply note for your awareness for Tuesday that one of the issues that might be involved in this conversation is the possibility of a donation crop credit that's currently being considered in the Senate but might become part of a larger bill. So anything else then on this discussion this morning? If not, we will close the work session on House Bill 4005, and we'll open the work session on our other bill, House Bill 4138. Okay. That's also yours, isn't it?
Yes. I can provide a summary.
Please. Yeah, I think the point of this one is to consider amendments that are needed in order to clarify where we are.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the apportionment for the interstate broadcasters. In OLIS, you have a -6 amendment, and it has hopefully been simplified a bit from an earlier version of the bill. To walk through it, we have Sections 1 and Section 2, which change the apportionment method from an audience-based method to one based on the domicile of the customers of the interstate broadcasters. The changes from earlier versions that you saw were to clarify that any company that is affected by the interstate broadcasters apportionment, and basically that is considered an interstate broadcaster under current law, will continue to be considered an interstate broadcaster under these changes. There would be no change in who is affected, either by inclusion or exclusion from these changes. So that part stays the same. So a lot of the changes from earlier amendments were to get at that as clearly as possible, that there would be no change on who is affected. The policy change is on how they are affected, and it's the apportionment method, from an audience-based method to the domicile of the customer, whether the customer is an advertiser or a licensee. So Sections 1 and Section 2 establish that new apportionment method. There is a 6-year sunset on the policy, and so Sections 3 and Sections 4 of the bill are the inverse of Sections 1 and 2.
This was last weekend.
This is just like the Olympics. Is this a trick? Slope style.
It's a team event, though. It's a team event.
I'll simply note that the first time I saw this, it was quite confusing, and now I just expect it.
if I can direct you to Section 5, in hopes of clarifying that, Sections 1 and 2 apply to tax years 2014 through 2019.
Yep.
That's the new method. Subsection 2 of Section 5. So Sections 3 and Section 4 apply to tax years beginning with 2020.
Okay.
So we just go back to existing law.
Right.
Okay. So I won't belabor that. Section 6 would require LRO to produce a report on the impact and utilization of this. So the language is pretty vague. Basically, by February of 2019, so probably to an interim legislature in 2018, we would come and present a report on this. We think it will be a pretty manual process. We only think there are maybe 6, 10, 12 of these interstate broadcasters, so it wouldn't require a large administrative issue for DOR. It would be manual by us to go over there and pull them out. But because there are only a handful of these, we expect that to be manageable in terms of producing that report. And then come back to you and describe in rough measures whether or not this aligned with your expectations. It would not be a refined audit-type calculation. So that's there. In you have the fiscal impact statement, which is a minimal impact, and you also have a draft revenue impact statement that I have here. And this is based on information provided by the Motion Picture Association of America. They basically went through their members and did a simulation of this policy versus the existing statute and came up with an estimate of about $900,000 that it would raise because of the shift in the apportionment. Now, so based on that 1 year, I've tried to move that forward to some extent, but there are a lot of unknowns with respect to how that revenue would come in. There are two pots, as the committee has heard, there are two pots of revenue, or at least for the bulk of the revenue, of advertising, which is about two-thirds, and licensing, which is about one-third. And so given all of the potential variation in this, what I have in here is largely a flat revenue forecast reported from the industry.
Very good. Representative Vega Peterson?
Thank you, Chair.
Did you want to speak to the amendment?
Yes, I did. So this is the Dash 6 is the result of a lot of work by the Department of Revenue, by LRO, and by people who are being affected by this bill to make sure that we're as clear as possible as far as what the intention of this is, that we're keeping the current definition of broadcasters and that we're keeping the current definition of who would be considered customers or we have very clear definitions of who would be considered a customer under this new bill. And we've been working with a lot of people and we've come to a really good place with this Dash 6 amendment. We do have the topsy-turvy Section 3 and 4 that sets the sunset. But again, that gives us an opportunity to have some time for LRO to do the report that they would need in order to get the information to see how this is actually impacting revenue, if it's doing the expectations that we have. And then if not, we can go back to the apportionment method.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Pence, please.
So I haven't had a chance to go through this in any detail, but one of the problems that I've had with the concept that's been brought before us is my inability to link the business activities in the state to the proposed method. And so I didn't want this to simply be a comparative outcome study. Okay, great. We happen to have a couple good, big, huge operations here, so the money is slightly greater, so hooray. And I've talked to Scott about this at length and trying to figure out how we could justify our ultimate decision based upon something more than just how much money we're raising. And so I'm very interested in what the foundational justification for utilizing the proposed method is from the state's position, not from the company's position. So I had thought there would be a series of strong foundations upon which we build this new law. And is it the activities of the entity inside the state, or is it the mere fact that some of their largest customers happen to be here? That seems odd. And so I'm very anxious to see how this comes out. And the staff explained to us what the true foundation for the proposal is. And I'm looking at some of the cases right now, and they're too complicated for me to suggest give us any particular help, so I won't mention them, other than to say that I think it's really important that we understand what the foundation for what we're doing is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And let me ask, to make sure I understand your comment, are you saying that we need a better foundation now, or that when the report comes in, the report needs to contain the information that will provide a foundation for the future?
Mr. Chair, the second. I want to make sure that staff understands my concern, at least, that the report ultimately say, here's what the outcome has been. But in case you're wondering, members of Oregon, and looking into the future, if things change, what is it that we point at? If Intel suddenly picked up and left, unlikely, but if it did, or Nike, what is it that we point at? Because, of course, then there's a dramatic shift in how much money we're actually picking up from this operation. And I think it was one-third, two-thirds is what I heard, the split. So this of that which comes from everyday revenues, which would still be here, and that which we are pointing at when it comes to the fortuitous location of these large companies. So what I want to make sure that we, in some way, identify why in the world we're using fortuitous location of these companies as the foundation for a tax. It seems odd to me.
What's the theory of this?
What is the theory of it? Okay. What is it?
I think I understand that. Now, let me ask the staff then, based on that question, does Section 6 capture that? Can you do that within the language in Section 6?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And we anticipate addressing whatever questions the committee has over the next few years to get at this policy to be in comprehensive report. That's why the language is high level. We didn't want to get down to do A, B, C, D, and E. That would be too restrictive an approach to get at the questions that the legislature has now and will likely have during the implementation of it.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to get this on the record. This is a very small piece of our tax structure. We, as a committee, struggle mightily with changes within industries, within the technology. I mean, we're constantly playing catch-up in taxes on changes that are going on around us, and I think this, in some way, is the foundation of this particular bill. I wish that when we do tax policy that's much bigger and much more impactful, we would spend as much time putting sunsets in, studying the tax implications and what happens, and then have clawbacks if what happens is measured, measurable, and we can then impact or go back or rethink. Unfortunately, too often, and I can think of a recent example in the special session, we do major tax policy without these kinds of pieces in place to study, to know what the impact was, and have ongoing measurements and a clawback if things go differently than we expect. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I am fully in favor of this methodology of addressing this tax change. Thank you.
And it sounds like you wish we had done that in October.
I do. Yeah.
May I join you in that wish? All right. Representative Baker Peterson.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. And I just wanted to respond to Representative Bent's question, because I think the foundation, the reason why we're doing this, and I think, you know, we are making this change because the industry has changed significantly from when this method of figuring out how much taxes this taxpayer owed was set. The industry is a lot different. This is more representative of who these taxpayers, customers, actually are, not the population method. And it's in line with what changes that are happening in other states that reflect, you know, the current technology of this industry.
Mr.
Chair, if I can
represent Vance, please.
I would just say thank you, Representative Peterson, for that thought. I would just say that but for those two businesses being situated in the state, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Because we wouldn't be able to tax them to the under the new approach that you're suggesting we should adopt. We would be all sitting here going, oh my goodness. Because that's why certain states, North Dakota, they're not going to be excited about this kind of an approach. And that's it's totally location-dependent of those who are utilizing these types of or engaging in these types of business. And great, it works for us, by the odd happenstance of having two large companies inside our state. Okay, that's fine, but that's not, in my opinion, the proper foundation for what we're about. notwithstanding the changes. It's an interesting one from the company side of things, not so much from the states. So understanding that to this point, it's great to be able to look to staff and have them sort it out for us, as usual.
Good.
I guess the only thing I would say is we still have all the licenses and fees, the licensing fees that we talked about. And also, it has to do with where a company's headquarters are. So even Intel's headquarters aren't in Oregon, you know, so that I know we've been using those interchangeably. But looking at how it actually works, I mean, we have a lot of local and small businesses that purchase airtime on for the broadcasters. And we have a lot of, you know, stations that are based here that would be the licensing fees. And then we do have, you know, a couple large headquarters here. But, you know, again, as Representative Berger says, this is a small pot of money, honestly, you know, in the overall scheme of how we're getting our tax revenues. That this just seems a little more logical, considering where the industry is at today.
And I would suggest something that I think has been hinted at, and that is if we have experience with this small item and learn from it, we might find ourselves able to apply similar methodology to larger items that actually will have much greater impact on the state revenues. And as Maine apparently has done with its R&D credit, by studying it carefully and what its impacts are, we might actually be able to figure out which of these methods actually work and which ones are a complete and utter waste of money, and thereby improve the state economy. So, I mean, I think one of my interests in pursuing this approach is that if it works, it gives us one more tool that we can use on bigger projects. All right. With that, we'll close the... Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Representative?
Are we going to move the amendment?
No. No, not today. No, we'll close the work session on House Bill 4138. Colleagues, I fully expect to have a conclusion for this whole set of things on Tuesday morning, and stay tuned. And the only topic I say that we haven't talked about that I know of today is the donation crop credit or deduction. I guess it's a credit. Yes, that might be included. If there are other things, get in touch with me right away. We are rapidly running out of time. And with that...
And all things going
yes,
well,
please.
Mr. Chair, I won't be here next week.
We're
now 5 days in the red zone, past the due date. And yesterday in committee, I called Tuesday the drop-dead date, which is the wrong word to use for,
yes. Definitely the wrong
for a pregnant
word
wife. Yes. I quickly learned.
Yes.
I think you'd know that by now.
I'll just say if the baby doesn't come by Tuesday, we will go get it.
One of the wonderful things about being a husband is that if you don't get it right, it will be explained to you. Thank you very much. And with that, we are adjourned.